So I'd like you all to settle down so as we can start our morning session. Thank you very much.
Senhora Presidente da
Comissão. So, President of the National Data Protection Board. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to be here once again in the House of Democracy and to be partners of the CNPD in this event, the interest of which was highlighted in by way of the speed with which the registrations were exhausted. About the topic, some will talk about with great knowledge about it, and so I'd like to take advantage of these opening words to tell you what we have done in APDSE. We have been together for 15 years, and so Dr. De Escoelha brought together a distinguished group that was committed to the work in creating this association intended for the development of the knowledge society that all the Portuguese benefit from. First of all, in our causes, we have the fight against info-exclusion, especially for the most vulnerable groups and those who... And so, therefore, we want to give access to all citizens. We also want to invest in all levels of education and development. So APDSE is an association that doesn't have any immediate correspondence abroad. It is not only a think tank, but it is a business group. But what it has individual and collective associates, both private and public. We believe that the information society can be a fundamental strand in the economic development of a country, both in the improvement of productiveness, productivity, and in the trade exchanges. The information society should also include a good governance paradigm, so transparency, civic participation, and the modernization of processes. Also, very recently, APDC was here to give its contribution to a digital parliamentary group. The support we have given to the poor, talented young Portuguese and the organization of the National IT Olympic Games. And this year we have we received a bronze medal that we should all be proud of. And so for us, we have a CPLP decided on the official glossary that produced by our specific working group. Information society can also be a space of assertion of the Portuguese language. I would like to conclude by talking about our topic today, safety and privacy. And APDC created a group on Safety and Information Society, conducted a number of studies and conferences, and it's through this group that is here today present. Today, these same agents want to show their partners and clients that take these concerns very seriously and are part of their values. Without false modesty, we think that we can give a contribution to this very positive evolution. Today's conference provokes a great deal of interest, and so once again we would like to thank you all who helped this become a reality. Thank you very much.
Sir
President of APDCI, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, allow me to greet you and say that because Mr. Ferreira Rodrigues is not going to be present in this opening session. In any case, I would like to highlights the relevance of the fact that we are meeting here in the Parliament, in this beautiful room, to discuss, to think about personal data protection in this time of change. It makes sense to be in a room and in a parliamentary establishment in order to think how through legislation this fundamental right can be protected. In April last year, the European Regulation of Data Protection Regulation was approved, and this following the directive that governed the data protection in the European space over the last 30 years, and it was to bring certain homogeneity in the regulation of data protection in the European Union, eliminating a number of factors that cause differences between the different legal systems in the member states. And so we are faced with a legal instrument that creates a great deal of challenges, especially to the data, the DPAs, and especially in terms of its main function of defending the fundamental rights of its citizens. And we can think of the possibility of appraising complaints from citizens being made not by the national authority, but by the authority of another member state, with possible options that will reflect in the culture of this other state's authority, in the event that the solution that can be found may not be easily understood by the complainant. And we can add this to the difficulties that citizens will have to face in order to appeal to this situation, that they will have to go to the courts of this other state that is still open in the present regulation. This is just an example of many of the concerns that the regulation raises. Until its application, which will occur in May 2018, there is still a long way to go by the companies and public organisations responsible for the personal data processing. And, for example, we have to adjust them to the new European legal framework and the protection, data protection authorities, in order to give a good response, an adequate response to the new tasks assigned. But on a political level, on a legislative level, there is still a great deal of things that need responses from member states under the pain of sacrificing the homogeneity that will come about with this new regulation, and decisions that have to be made in the legislation in each member state. And that is why we are thinking about the alterations resulting from the new regime and trying to find solutions in coordination with the data protection authorities from the other member states in the European Union in order to carry out this task. And more than just presenting today our view of the new European legal framework, we want to know the perspective of the specialists, of data protection specialists, companies, public bodies, citizens. In short, we want to hear the community that we serve in order to understand their expectations, their fears, and their suggestions. And that is why we have to extend the debate to the whole community, and that is why we, together with APDCI, are organizing this conference, which reflects this idea of opening up to society. This has got to do with the participation of a number of speakers with a great deal of experience in this area, and that come from different areas. To our guests, I would like to leave you a word of thanks. But allow me to give my very personal thanks to Dr. Christopher Kuna, David Wright, and Esther Massey for being with us here today, highlighting the importance of their contribution to the discovery of integrated solutions within the European space. In the same way, we invited three journalists to chair the sessions, and this was not a random choice. We wanted the reflection and the discussion not to be influenced only by our perspective of the regulation, but we wanted to hear the perspective of other professionals. And if this is not a closed conference, and so it's fundamental to have the collaboration of people who, because of the professional contribution, will cause a good debate. So I would like to thank the three journalists for being with us today. So I would like to talk about APDCI, which I would like to greet in the person of its president, Mr. Mishkaranyash, and note that the nature of this association is under private law, opens the way for us to receive different contributions. I would like to include this intervention by declaring this session open. Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. Well, I would just like to begin by thanking the National Data Protection Board, sir, and the APDCI for the invitation to invite me to talk about the cross-border dimension that this new European data protection regulation is going to bring to our life and the impact that this is going to have on public authorities and how the supervision of this question of data protection is going to work. And we have 20 months, almost 2 years, for this regulation to come into force, which will replace the current one. And so in Portugal, things are done a little bit later than others, but in this case, we have the opportunity in almost 2 years to be able to at least reflect and understand how the new policy, or European policy on data protection is going to work. Now, this part of the conference, and so, Professor, at this part of the conference, this session, we have Dr. Kuna and Dr. Farinha will give their presentations, and if there are questions, we have a great pleasure to hear them here, and perhaps we'll have a little discussion on these issues. So the organizers have invited these specialists. Both are the law professors. Christopher Kuna comes from the Brussels University. He's associated with the University of Cambridge, and he's an invited professor of the London School of Economics. He is the author of various articles on the data privacy law. And just as Dr. Domingos Farinha has work published on the intimacy of private life, and so I'd like to start off by giving the floor to Professor Kuna. You have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. That's very kind. I'd like to thank, first of all, the Portuguese Data Protection Authority for inviting me to this event. I'm very honored to be here, especially to be able to speak in this beautiful building of the Portuguese Parliament is really an honor and very impressive. And I'm very impressed at how this has been organized and how many of you are here and are interested in data protection. As was said, I'm a law professor in Brussels, and I have various other affiliations, all of which have to do with data protection at different universities, and I've also written quite a lot about this data protection in general and this new instrument we have, the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR. I have, I think, about 30 minutes to speak. So I will go through my talk. I also have a set of slides which will be projected up here. Unfortunately, I apologize that I do not speak Portuguese, so I will be speaking in English, and my slides are in English. I believe that they will be made available on the web after this event. But feel free, although I have to leave fairly soon after this morning session, if you have any questions, you could certainly feel free to ask them during the question and answer session. And I'd also like to thank the interpreters, who I can't see you, but you have a very important role. And I will try not to speak too fast so that you can interpret what I say. So let's begin with the first slide, and what is this new instrument that we will be talking about today, the GDPR? Well, it's a massive revision of the rules for data protection in Europe as they concern the private sector, but also public authorities. This is an EU regulation which was enacted in April of this year and provides a comprehensive and harmonized framework for data protection law, which is applicable in all member states. And it's important to say, as an EU regulation, this is directly applicable and there is no need for national implementation in comparison with the directive which we have now. So this means that the Portuguese Data Protection Act will either disappear or it will be greatly minimized or reduced, because this will be replaced now by EU law that applies directly. And as I said, it applies both to the private sector but also for public authorities in processing your personal data. There is also a separate directive, which is called the Police Directive, that covers data processing by law enforcement and police authorities, and I will not be discussing that here. The regulation was enacted to provide to try to fill gaps in protection that have become apparent over the last few years and few decades under the directive. For all of its strengths, there's been a general understanding that the legal framework for data protection needs reform, and this is what the GDPR is doing. It will become applicable on 25th of May, 2018. That may seem a long time, but actually it's not. Time moves very fast, especially as you get older. You realize that it moves very fast, and this will be upon us very quickly. So this is why we need to start to think about it already. And despite its harmonizing effect, there are a number of uncertainties with regard to how this will work in practice, and I will go over these in my slides. Now, I have been asked to speak about the transborder dimension of the GDPR and the new rules and what changes this will bring under the current rules. And this has been an area of concern in the current data protection framework. People have often felt that as their data are transferred or processed across national borders, they do not receive adequate protection. They don't understand how they can exercise their rights, and they don't always trust that the data will be processed in compliance with the law. I see this issue of the transborder dimension in two ways here. First of all, there's the transborder dimension within the EU. The EU is, of course, one single entity for regulatory purposes as data protection is concerned, but it's also comprised of 28 sovereign member states, or 27 once we have Brexit. So there are a lot of differences between the legal frameworks in the member states, and there's also a lot of cultural differences and differences in legal systems. So even within the EU, there is a transborder dimension. As your data are collected in Portugal and may be processed in another member state, you might have questions about how to exercise your rights, for example. Which law applies to the processing of your data? To whom can you turn? Which data protection authority is responsible if you have a complaint? And an example can be seen in situations where a company has contacts with different member states. So a company may have different establishments in different member states. The management headquarters may be located in one member state, but the main place of data processing in another member state. And we'll see this later when I discuss the Weltimmo judgment of the Court of Justice. Then, of course, there's what I call the external transborder dimension, which applies to processing of data outside the EU in what are called third countries, namely countries that are not members of the EU. How does EU data protection law apply to data processing outside of the EU? And an obvious example here is an individual in the EU interacts with a website which is established in a third country. And again, has the same questions. Is this secure? Who do I turn to if I want to exercise my rights? Which rights do I even have? So all of this has led to a great deal of uncertainty and to concern with how data processing or how data protection law actually works in practice and what rights people have. Now, these rules, as they now exist, have led to confusion and to frustration among all parties. This is, of course, largely a concern of individuals, but there are others who are involved in data processing, and all parties have had concerns in this regard. So, as I said, individuals do not know which law applies to their data processing and who are to turn to complaints. Businesses also have had a lot of complaints. So many times businesses conduct the same data processing, let's say via the internet or online technologies in multiple member states, and they don't know which law applies also. Sometimes there are multiple laws that apply, which causes a great deal of extra cost and burden and also confusion. And then, of course, remember the position of the data protection regulators. They're also a party which is affected by this uncertainty. They have difficult issues where people come to them and they have to try to apply maybe Portuguese law in a third country, or it's not clear which law applies. So this also creates a lot of burden on regulators. The data protection regulators traditionally have not had a lot of resources, and this just creates inefficiency and burden on the regulators as well. So really, these are problems for all of society, not just for individuals. Now, I give you a couple of examples of these situations in practice, which are drawn from recent judgments of the Court of Justice of the EU in Luxembourg. A very famous case, Schrems versus Data Protection Commissioner, you may have heard of this. It was been in a lot of the newspapers because it resulted in the invalidation by the court of the EU-US safe harbor regime, which was a regime that legalized data transfers to the US. And this case involved Max Schrems, an Austrian law student, who was concerned about the processing of his personal data in Austria by Facebook. And he complained to the Austrian Data Protection Authority about this. The Austrian Data Protection Authority then had to say, we're sorry, under the current rules of data protection, we do not have jurisdiction over the Facebook entity, which is responsible for the acts that you are complaining of, because in Austria there is no data controller for Facebook. So you have to go to Ireland and complain to the Irish Data Protection Authority. That's where Facebook has its main establishment in the EU. That's where the data controller for the Facebook services is. So he then went to made a complaint in Ireland, and this is a whole saga which you can read about on the internet on his webpage. But you can imagine this is quite a burden on an individual. For him, it wasn't such a problem because he was interested anyway in data protection law. He speaks perfect English, so to write complaints to Ireland wasn't a problem. But for most citizens in the EU, this would be in probably impossible burden. People don't have the time. It's more costly to interact with a regulatory authority in another country. There's also a very important language issue. So most people would just give up at that point and say, all right, I just forget it then. This is too difficult. So you can see under the current system, this does not work very well. Most of the large IT companies have their headquarters in Ireland for tax and other reasons. So it causes a sort of forum shopping whereby everyone has to go and make complaints in Ireland, and this is not really an adequate situation. It's far too burdensome. And if you consider the transborder dimension within the EU, there are also issues that arise. So here is another case from the Court of Justice, Welt-Immo, from the 1st of October, 2015. This is a very interesting case, which shows even within the EU there can be a lot of confusion about making complaints. So this case concerned a company which is registered as a company in Slovakia. But it ran a website which was dealing with real property in Hungary, so renting flats, selling houses, etc. There were advertisers on this website in Hungary who then complained to the Hungarian Data Protection Authority. And at this point, the company, Welt-Immo, said, no, the Hungarian authority does not have jurisdiction over us. We are in Slovakia. We have our headquarters and our registered office in Slovakia. So there was then questions that arise, which law applies here? Is this Hungarian law? Is it Slovakian law? And then also, which data protection authority should enforce this law? Is it the Hungarian or the Slovakian? And the Court of Justice here made an interesting decision, saying that the applicable law is different than the determination of jurisdiction. And so they basically found that, yes, it's Hungarian law that applies, but the Hungarian Data Protection Authority cannot enforce their own law in Slovakia. They have to cooperate and work with the Slovakian Data Protection Authority. So this becomes a bit complicated when you have a lot of different laws, and companies are routinely spread out among different countries, and it can be difficult even to know which law applies and which regulator to turn to. Another good example of the external dimension is the famous Google Spain case. You've also probably all heard about this too, where Google, of course, operates a search engine, and it has an entity established in Spain, a subsidiary there, but the instrumentalities that run the search engine are actually located in California and are under the direct control of the headquarters in California. However, the Spanish subsidiary promotes and sells advertising space, which was offered by the Google headquarters. And then when an individual complains to the Spanish DPA about data processing by the search engine, the question arose, does Spanish data protection law even apply to this data processing by the search engine? And of course, the Court of Justice said yes, because they said this data processing is carried out in the context of the activities of the Spanish subsidiary. So the court did apply EU data protection law, but this was after a very long process, and it was not always very clear how this would turn out. Excuse me. So those are just examples of three recent cases by the Court of Justice, which I think show the current uncertainty under the existing data protection directive. So you may ask then, all right, how will this be changed? What will be remedied under the GDPR? Well, the GDPR will, at least in theory, try to fix these problems in different ways. First of all, under the internal, in the internal cross-border dimension, individuals will always be able to turn to their local data protection authorities. So you won't have the situation I described earlier in Schrems, where you have to write to another data protection authority in a different language. Secondly, for the business's point of view, there is what is called a one-stop shop, which means that there will be one data protection authority which is their main regulator, so that they will not be regulated by multiple data protection authorities. Now, this is the way it will work in theory. Whether it's so clear in practice is something we can discuss. And then for data protection regulators, there are different mechanisms that are set up, in particular the so-called cooperation mechanism and the consistency mechanism, which are supposed to ensure that they can work together better and also that they take the same positions on the same issue so that there isn't a great difference in opinions on the same issues. And then for the external dimension, there is a further extension of the jurisdictional scope of EU law to fill gaps in protection, to give, at least in theory, greater protection to individuals when their data are processed outside the EU. Now, these rules are a bit complicated, and they can become very technical, and I have to say they're complicated even for experts or people who work in this field. If you look at this GDPR, it's very long. It's 120 pages. It's really very, very complicated. So I'm not going to go into great detail in it, because I know this isn't the purpose of this event. I want to just try to give you an overview or a flavor of what these new procedures will mean and how they could, in theory, help improve the situation of individuals, of companies, and of regulators. And then I also want to point out a few of the questions that arise about them. So I mentioned there will be established under the GDPR a so-called one-stop shop, which is a lead DPA, which will then be competent for the data protection, for the cross-border data processing activities of the company. And this single lead DPA is determined based on the company's so-called main establishment or single establishment in the EU. This means that companies will have a single contact point for cross-border data processing activities. And if you think of an example, famous example, Google Street View, Google driving around taking videos of the streets, and you can access it on the internet, and it can be very useful if you're trying to navigate, but it also has data protection issues. And in that, there were this exact same activity, and the opinions of it were completely different in different member states. Some data protection authorities said, no problem, you can do it. In other member states, they said, well, you can do it, but with some conditions. And then a third group said, impossible, you can't do it at all. And I think we realize if we have a single market within Europe, it doesn't make sense. If you have the exact same activity, why should it be subject to such radically different interpretations? So this will mean a company can turn to just one data protection authority. Now, you can imagine that this process may not always work as smoothly as it seems in theory, because there is a lot of difference between different legal regimes for data protection, and not just in the written law, but in the legal culture, in the civil law. These are things which are not affected by the GDPR, and they go very deep because they have deep historical roots. So we may see at the beginning, I think, a little bit of friction as to how to reach common understanding of these rules under the GDPR. But at least in theory, this should mean that there's just one stop for a company to go to have an opinion about their cross-border activities. Now you say, how is this going to be determined? Well, the one-stop shop is based on the so-called main establishment of the company's activities. This is generally the main place where decisions are made about data processing, which in many cases is the place of the country's central administration in the EU. But of course there are exceptions, which I won't go into detail here because they get very complicated, whereby there are other establishments in the EU could be considered the main establishment. And then in case of disagreement between the DPAs, there will be established something called the European Data Protection Board, which I think you will hear a lot about in the course of today's conference. And this is the successor to the current Article 29 Working Party. The Data Protection Board will have independent legal personality. It will be subject to judicial review under EU law. So it's quite a significant upgrade, because the Article 29 really at the moment is just a group of data protection authorities who meet and talk, and they may agree on papers, but these papers have no legal effect. This will all change under the Data Protection Board. And it's also important to say, of course, there will still be many data protection issues that are purely local, have purely local significance. So, for example, if a shop wants to is worried about theft and they want to have video surveillance and they need to get an authorization from the local data protection authority, if this is just a local shop, then that should be determined by the local DPA. So the Data Protection Board and the one-stop shop will not apply to everything. The one-stop shop will apply more to cross-border matters, and the local DPA will still be authorized to deal with really purely local matters, with, however, a few exceptions. Now, in order to make this system work, there has to be also ways for the data protection authorities to cooperate between themselves and to reach a consistent view of legal issues. And I think it's fair to say, until now, there has been not always complete harmony or agreement between data protection authorities on common issues. So the GDPR establishes two mechanisms to try to reach these goals, the so-called cooperation mechanisms and the consistency mechanism. And I will briefly describe these to you now. So the cooperation mechanism is in Article 60, and this is designed to help reach consensus between the data protection authorities. And this means that the lead data protection authority under the one-stop shop must still cooperate with other data protection authorities concerned, because even if There is maybe one authority which is mainly concerned with an issue. There may be others that also have some kind of stake in it. So they must try to reach a common position. It's also significant that data protection authorities must provide mutual assistance, and they may conduct joint operations. So there is now a legal basis, for example, for having joint investigations, joint audits by different data protection authorities, which could be different types of audits of a company's operations in different member states. So there's a much stronger legal basis now for the data protection authorities to work together. Beyond the cooperation mechanism, there's also a consistency mechanism, and this can be thought of as a kind of dispute resolution mechanism between the DPAs, which up till now has been completely lacking because the Article 29 has been a very informal body. So there's a possibility for the European Data Protection Board to issue a binding decision if a lead DPA does not want to follow the proposal of another DPA. So we have a real binding dispute resolution mechanism here under the Data Protection Board. This is also designed to ensure consistent application of the GDPR because, as I said, legally speaking, it's clear an EU regulation is not implemented into national law. It simply applies directly and without variation. However, because this will need to be interpreted by courts, by data protection authorities in practice, and they have very different legal backgrounds and legal cultures, there is a potential for a divergence in interpretation of it. And so here, as I've outlined, there is a procedure whereby the European Data Protection Board can try to issue a binding decision, or there can be consultations between the data protection authorities to reach a general consistent application and interpretation of the GDPR. Now, that's the kind of internal transborder dimension. What about the external dimension? What about individuals dealing with third countries and data processing abroad? Well, at the moment, there's a bit of a gap in the law because under the applicable law rules, there can be situations where an individual is interacting, let's say, with a website in a third country, and EU law may not apply. So, for example, if an individual is going on the web and browsing on a foreign non-EU website, and this website is structured in such a way that it is not using different technologies like cookies or web beacons and others on its website, it's possible that EU law may not apply to that interaction. The Court of Justice has gotten around this problem, and it did that in the Google Spain case, by taking a broad interpretation of what constitutes processing data in the context of an establishment in the EU. But this is a kind of legal fiction and is not maybe a strong enough basis for really providing a strong protection and strong application for EU data protection law in third countries. So in order to fix this situation, we have Article 3 of the GDPR, which applies to the application of EU law abroad in third countries outside of the EU. And under Article 3, EU law will apply independently of whether a company is physically present in the EU, and will cover the online sale of products, web-based services, or mobile tracking of individuals. And it does this by using a so-called targeting approach. So this means that EU law applies to companies outside the EU which are offering goods or services, including those that are free to individuals in the EU, or when there is monitoring of the behavior of individuals within the EU. So this could be through some sort of online tracking or some sort of online profiling, for example. And this codifies cases of the Court of Justice. So this will really fill the gaps in some of the provisions of the GDPR and mean that there's a lot more possibility that EU law will apply to, in particular, websites from outside the EU that are accessible within the EU. And so EU law is really being exported globally and will have a lot of application much more in third countries than is currently the case. I'm getting now to the end of my allotted 30 minutes, and so I'd like to just raise some questions for the future, because it's one thing to enact such a lengthy EU regulation. This was the process of many years of work and huge amount of thousands of people involved in different EU institutions, also from outside the EU, academics, companies, NGOs, etc. And so with a great deal of difficulty, because it was very politically controversial, this was now passed, and so we have the legal text. That part of this is over, but now I think even the more difficult part begins. We have to take this massive legal text and actually understand it and apply it in practice. And there are a number of questions that will be important to applying this effectively in practice. So one of them is, how will the European Data Protection Board work in practice? A great deal of the success of the GDPR will be dependent on this European Data Protection Board being a really effective pan-EU regulator for data protection. And I think, at least at the beginning, it's quite likely that there will be some friction, as I said, because this will be the first time data protection authorities have really been forced to work together in a legally binding sense. It also will create a bit of tension, because the data protection authorities are supposed to be independent. We know that the Court of Justice has said this in three different cases. So there's a bit of a natural tension if you say, on the one hand, you're completely independent, and on the other hand, you say, but you also have to work together. That's somehow, it seems a little bit contradictory to me. Secondly, will this really be applied in a harmonized manner? And the legal books on EU law will tell you EU regulation just applies directly and it's harmonized and there's no possibility really for national variation. Well, how will this work with, for example, national civil law? What about constitutional law? I can already see on the horizon some potential conflicts between EU law and national constitutional law here. With regard to the processing of data by third countries, say companies in the U.S. and elsewhere, this is dependent on the interpretation of terms such as targeting and monitoring of behavior. How will these terms be applied and defined in practice by the DPAs and the courts? Number four, it's fine to apply the law in a legal sense, but then you have to enforce it, and it's difficult to enforce EU law outside of the EU. Within the EU, we have mechanisms for this, but if the data are being processed in Brazil, in the US, in Malaysia, in China, the EU Data Protection Authority has no enforcement jurisdiction there. So will there be a gap opening up between application of the law and actually enforcement of it? And then finally, this is maybe more of a political issue. We have a very difficult time now in Europe. We have fragmentation on a political level. We have a lot of Euroscepticism. And now we will have this big project replacing a lot of national law with suddenly one pan-EU instrument. And I wonder, too, how will this be accepted by citizens who maybe have, for example, in my country, Germany, they have a lot of attachment to the German data protection law and tradition, and suddenly this is replaced by an EU instrument. How will that be accepted? Will it be accepted? I hope it will, and I hope that the GDPR really marks the coming of age of a really European view of data protection. But there are a number of challenges ahead. So I think my time is up, and I turn the floor over again.
Vamos só fazer aqui uma verificação técnica para que os dados não se percam.
Muito bom dia a todos.
Good morning, everybody. I would like to begin by greeting my colleagues here, and I would like to greet everybody here present, and I would like to thank CNDP and APDSI for this invitation, for organizing this very important event. And this is a great honor for me to be invited here because I've been working for many years on the transfer of data from the European Union to outside the European Union. And today, well, I have the opportunity to talk about this. And so I'm going to talk about something a little bit different. So I'm very pleased about this. And so we can see from the presentation that you have here, the topic has got to do with the speaker before me, which has got to do with processing. And so this will be divided into two moments, that is, task of the type of processing from the general point of view, and then a specific area where there are novelties, which is processing with a projection to subsequent transfer, which are called onward transfers, rather. And so I'd like to say and try and explain exactly the legislation, and for those who know the legislation, I'd like to know why processing was chosen as a subject that deserves a special attachment. And so many of you will know this. Could you ask the gentleman to slow down a little bit, please? He's going very, very fast. And so there's a novelty here. This is not new, but it has already been treated by the directors and the data protection. Well, thank you very much indeed. And so, I'd like to apologize to the interpreter, says the gentleman. Thank you. And so, what is the novelty? Well, this processing was already set out in the previous regime, and we can find it both in the directive and our data protection law. It's a transposition in this case, ipsis verbis. And so what do we actually find both in the directive enforces and the other one is a very simple idea, and that idea continues in the regulation, as has happened in many areas of the regulation. That is the will of the regulator in the union to specify and quite many times to resolve specific cases that raised a number of very complex problems. And so what do we find today? And this is summed up in the idea of binding the processor to the persons, the entity responsible, the data controller. And so this is underlying the whole idea of processing. So I'd just like to say that if there is there's a topic that can have difficulty in interpreting in a number of different official directions of the topic, this is my topic that we're going to talk about today. And so to give you three examples, so if you look at the English version, the Portuguese version, the Spanish version, you will find different names for the different for the same expressions. Now, the English talk about controller and processor, the Spanish say the person responsible or the entity responsible, and the encargado, and we call it processes of information. They are responsible for information, and we call that subcontractor, which is the processor. And so it should, the word should be a different word in Portuguese, but in any way, just to say that we're talking about the same thing, and it's very normal for us to compare different versions of the regulation, but it's very important for us to talk about the same thing. That this is very important to see what is new here. And so there's a fundamental issue, which is the link of the topic of processing in general and the novelty, which is a specific processing of in terms of the transfer of international data. I would say that the companies, that is the companies in the current regime, and especially with the great effort of the international authorities, have already understood or already applied the current regime to the international transfer of data, which has got to do with the relationship with the 25th article and the article 19.1 of the data protection law. And so there was an effort to integrate the matters related to processing and the problems that it causes in the international transfer of data. Now, they'd understood this, and I think rightly so, that this processing was not enough. It was too implicit, and sometimes the interpretation was a little bit extensive, and so, but they needed real clear rules of how we are going to deal with processing in terms of the international transfer of data. Now, this is our starting point, and so we're going to have a more specific idea of what is kept and what is not kept in this new regulation. Well, the first idea that I mentioned a while ago is that the extension of the protection that is set out in the regulation for the data controller should be extended to processor. Then, so this idea, and so I'd like to start here, and that is between the directive and the regulation, there was a technological evolution that raised a very practical problem. That is, when the directive was thought about and actually entered into force, it was very normal that the controller actually treated this in the data in-house, that is, it collected information, it gathered information and processed it. So the problem of processing is to regulate the exit of information to other third parties was not a problem that really worried the EU authorities. But when we actually fast forward to the moment that the regulation was drawn up, what we're going to find is a very different situation. Now there's a whole market around the processing of information, and especially this the most complicated practical processes as a market and submarkets for the processing of information. Now, to give you an example that's well known by everybody, Schwemm's agreement, that I think it was mentioned before, and I think that most of you know it, and that is an excellent example that we're going to talk about before in the terms of in terms of processing and the transfer, international transfer of data. With somebody, we have the Facebook Limited, which is an Irish company. But as soon as it receives the information, and this is what Max Schrems discovered when... What he discovered was that quite often Facebook Limited transfers its information to a Facebook Incorporated. Now, this is a North American company. And so that means that from that moment, there's somebody, there's a controller responsible for Facebook, Irish Facebook, and then there's a North American processor. Now, this is not the real problem. Now, the problem is that the North American Facebook processes the contractors, the chain, with dozens of companies that are specialized in processing different information. There's those that process information that just face recognition, Facebook, and there's others that have the GPS, and there's others that deal with information got to do with family relations between the Facebook users and so on and so forth. And so North American Facebook hires many companies to process information, and it was constituted in Ireland, but somebody was in Austria. And so some of the companies, and we're going to talk about this later, the North American Facebook contracts are not even in the United States. Either can be Canada, and some are in South America. And so that is why, when I said the first footnote in the slide, you can see that from the point of view of the relationship between the controller and the processor, the relationship is the same. But in practical terms, things are different. So this is fairly sensitive in the international areas, that is, in terms of the international transfer of data. And so the no, the Articles 44 and 45 are novelties, and so the two examples of the most important novelties. And now, if you want, if you look at the whole section of the chapter regarding the international transfer of data is a novelty in terms of processing, and so we're going to talk about this later, but I want you to take into account this idea that there's a contrast between something that remains, that is the concern of maintaining, of guaranteeing legally that all the whole chain of processes means that it's it's controlled by the controller, and so then we have the process in the context of international transfer of data, and the situation here is a little bit more serious, as was highlighted by the previous speaker. Now, this is the only slide where I'm going to be a little bit more technical, says the gentleman. So let's look at Article 28, and so when I say that we still have the concern about the processing, but we have to see what this reinforcement is, and so this was addressed before, and that is the idea of main establishment is clearly presented by the process, and so all the case law, Google Spain, for example, that there is no doubt that this applies to the controller, the data controller, but the main establishment with the whole scope that the Court of Justice gives to the process. And so this is the first example of what I understood by the controller. I'm going to apply the same thing to the processor in terms of main establishment. The second aspect, which is important, and this is probably the most important thing in terms of the principle of the regulation. It says in 28.1, and I'm going to read it, says the gentleman, which, and the interpreters do not have this in front of them.
O responsável pelo tratamento recorre apenas a subcontratantes que apresentem garantias suficientes de execução de medidas técnicas e organizativas adequadas, de uma forma que o tratamento satisfaça aos requisitos do presente regulamento e assegure a defesa dos direitos do titular dos dados.
Sorry about that, but simplifying sometimes the English language has its advantages, that it's called back-to-back protection, meaning that I have to find this, and we'll leave this for the lawyers later, we have to find a way to guarantee that the first protection, just as it is framed legally, it's between the holder of the data, the person responsible for the processing, all the contacts between the controller and the processor will have back-to-back protection. That means the last link in the chain has to be bound to the same thing as the controller right in the first relationship. And so this was not sufficiently clear, and it still isn't in the directives, and this is the concern of Article 28, etc. And so 28.2, that is processing without authorization, that whereas the first chain is possible, it is authorized by way of a number of features in the regulation, then afterwards I always have to express authorization of to continue with this processing chain, because the regulation as the director before it was thought, because what I am talking is the relationship between the holder of the data and the data controller. And another is the way the regulation, the relationships have to be under contract. And so there is, so for example, before the relationship between the data controller, any breaches occurred in the chain. Now, this was thought about the whole legal chain from the establishment of undertakings until a non-fulfillment of these obligations. And so this was a very serious situation. For example, if I am the first processor and I undertook to the controller and so I'm always accountable to the controller, even if there are eight processors after me. So there's a sharing of risk, a joint risk, and this is obviously important. And once again, it reinforces the back-to-back relationship. But The idea that a code of conduct or certifications can be a way to show compliance, and this is the way the EU is, wants it to show that it was worried about the relationship over the processes. It doesn't want to make it too bureaucratic, too heavy. And so the mechanisms that have to be used in the context and the relationship between data, personal data processing between the holder and the controller can be used in the relationship with the processor through a code of conduct or certificates. And as an example, the possibility to have a general clauses and that they already exist in the light of the directive in these instruments, which are excellent for the transfer of data inside the Union and outside the Union, and are set out in Article 28.6-8. And basically they say there's absolutely nothing new in this relationship with the processor if we want to use the general clauses, which allows us to anticipate the relationships in the chain. So now I'd like to talk about the current sense of this new protection. What do we want to achieve with this new regulation? What has been... The first aspect is to reinforce the aspect that I mentioned a while ago, is that the substantive regime was originally thought to, based on the directive that was reinforced in the regulation for the relationships between the holder of the rights and the controller, and so this should be maintained until the last user of the information. That is, if it exists and during the period it exists, and as to the information that the controller can process. Now, the idea is, and this was the practical problem that resulted in the success of processing by the processor. I cannot throw, for example, throughout the life of the directive, I cannot have problems or black areas where I don't know what is applied to the processor, because the directive was only worried about the controller. And it goes even further. There's a problem that we can also, procedural regime, there was concerns about making the processor equal to the controller. Now there's a new figure for the controller, that is the data protection officer, as he has to exist in certain situations for those who are responsible for the processor. The controllers and have to exist for the processor. I mean, they have to have the duplication of this figure, but it's the same thing. The right to action, which was a right already foreseen for the controller, which is set out in the regulation in regard to processors, whoever they are. And so there's not a question of guaranteeing that there's going to be a full equivalence and conformity with the regimes of the controller and the processors, only substantively, but procedurally too. And now I would like to give you some information about data protection of the international data transfer within the context of processing. So I gave you an example a while ago, and we're going to change Article 28 to Article 44. But second, that is why I said at the beginning, I'm going to talk about a topic that's very dear to me. It is obvious that in terms of processing, it is much more serious and much more important, and this explains why it was dealt with in a new way in the regulation. It's much more important within the context of the international transfer of data for two reasons. Why for two reasons? Because in the context of the process within the EU law, there are many cases where the controller processes its data in-house, and so that minimizes the problem. And so, because even when it doesn't process them, the problem of a breach, which was explained before and now in the EU regulation, so the equivalence between the relationship of the holder of the data with the controller and or with the processor, the holder of the data and the processor, and so before this regulation didn't even know what these relationships were. Well, no, now that we have mechanisms, consistency mechanisms, recovery mechanisms, we're going to have a stronger regulator on the central level, and the problems that could exist would be solved more easily. And this doesn't happen with the international transfer of data. We can go back to the Schwanz example. When the information left Facebook in Ireland, then now I have a number of problems, and so the substantive regime is the least of these problems. And this is a problem of enforcement. That is how I'm going to enforce this regime. And so there's a shield in the relationships between Europe and the United States. And so this is a special problem. Now, in fact, the European legislator anticipated the problem, complex problem, by treating this matter in terms of the international transfer of data, something that wasn't set out in the directive. Now, in order to be able to talk about the possibility to have an international transfer of data, this transfer has to integrate information about whether there's going to be a processing, there's going to be a processor. And so the export itself is already a relationship with the process in most cases. But this, the consequence of the Schwanz judgment, and this is critical of safe fiber, and so to have an adequate protection, so to know that when a given state deserves to receive personal data from the European Union, the decision taken by the EU has to take into account the detailed information, that is, a specific information about who the processors are. And so perhaps this is the most important aspect, because this means that we're going to have to be very careful when we want to import or export information outside the European Union, because I'm going to have to be very careful when I detail and to know beforehand, because there's another problem that's going to be placed in the company. That's to know beforehand and detail who my processors are, what type of information they're going to process, and in which context and for how long. I just cannot have exported information from the EU and say, look, I'm the controller, the data controller, and from now on, the rest is up to me, you don't have to know anything. Now, European law is going to say, look, when you export data, you have to say who you're going to export this data to, and who is going to do this, and so, and who is going to receive the information once it gets to the origin. Now, this is going to raise a number of problems, and the regulation has got to do with cloud computing, which is which is being analysed in a number of countries in the Union and in the Commission itself. But without having problems of cloud computing, this raises a number of very important problems. And to conclude, let's look at, see what conclusions can actually be drawn from this. The general processing that we find in the regulation, on the other hand, this new processing or new treatment that's done in terms of the international transfer of data in the by way of the processor. So I would say, and this is a very modest conclusion, but before the practical application or the regulation arrives, we have to clarify the place of the processor from a legal point of view. Now, I don't want to undermine the work that has been done up to now on the directive. A lot of work has been done on the area of the processors. And so what this regulation has done has helped, from a practical point of view, companies process and have to regulate their situation. They have to know exactly what areas they have to be more highly aware of. And in international terms, we have a novelty here, because we find a new regulation of the role of processors that not only function as a condition for this data transfer to be about to become a reality. And I'd also like to say one more thing, and that is the European Union legislator was fully aware of the mechanisms that have been used to, and together with the decisions of adequate protection on the export data outside the European Union. It's included in the general clause of the binding corporate rules, which are very important. And the union and the regulation said that these mechanisms can also be used to regulate the process in relationships. And so this has, in one of the recitals, it says that it's a good practice for the processor to appear in the legal relationship that is established between the holder of the data and the data controller. I don't know if this is the best option legally. I think it's the most important. It is better to have another kind of relationship. So that would be a separate legal relationship between the controller and the processor and the data, the holder of the data and the controller. And so I would just like to say that the relationships should be understood, processes should be understood within the context of the market, which are very complex in the European Union, but also in the United States, where they use specialist entities to process data from the same country. And so we're talking about huge companies where they have no longer the ability for economic efficiency and for technical requirements to do in-house their processing. And so the legal regulation of the controller with these different processes is today fundamental for us to accept the data transfer made outside the European Union. Thank you very much for your attention.
Eu não sei se há perguntas da assistência.
I don't know if anyone would like to ask any questions. We will probably have a few questions in just a minute. We have around half an hour, 40 minutes for Q&A. This conference is taking place here in Parliament and in this room, which has already been a witness to other debates, and if it could tell the stories of what it's heard, I think it would be worthwhile. But just to say that the Parliament, as the home for democracy, deals with citizens' rights, and that's why it exists, and that's why it makes sense that we have this conference here. And going into greater detail, what I'd like to ask the two of you is, with this new regulation, what assurances are given to the citizens that the data that was shared with a given company in a given contract are more protected or less protected? And I'd like to start with Professor Kuno, if you could answer, please.
I should say also, I know this afternoon there's going to be a session specifically dealing with citizens' rights, so I'm not going to go into that specifically. I think that it will be better protected under the regulations. Certainly, some of the major problems that have impeded the exercise of citizens' rights are at the basis of the GDPR. So, for example, lack of harmonization. We know that despite all of the problems, that we have political problems of fragmentation, now it's become very common for citizens to move between different member states and maybe work in one member state and live in another one, or marry someone from another member state and travel around. So people have become very mobile within the EU, but data protection law has been very nationally based, and there have been a lot of differences in it. So the problem with fragmentation has been addressed, and it will be largely eliminated, not completely eliminated. Just to choose one other topic, it's a lot of thought was given to trying to improve the ability of citizens to assert their rights and to do so more effectively. And so from a legal point of view, I think this is a much stronger document versus the directive. However, as I said, how does this work in practice? We have to always remember the European Court of Human Rights and the European Court of Justice have said for a good standard protection of human rights, there are two things necessary. First, there has to be a strong legal framework. And secondly, there has to be effective protection in practice. And I think in the EU, we've been very good at the first of these criterion, but it's the second one, the protection in practice has been very lacking. And I hope this is then improved under the GDPR.
Professor Domingos Farinho, é a mesma questão, os cidadãos ficam mais protegidos.
For you also, whether citizens are more or less protected with this new regulation? Well, thank you for the question. I have no doubt that any citizen with a relationship with data protection authorities, and that if the citizen knows that the rights are protected, then obviously a citizen will feel more comfortable. And it's very difficult. No one provides a data protection level as the EU does. But there is an interesting gap when we take into consideration economic requirements, and especially when we talk about the TTIP. TTIP is not included in, or does not include the personal data because there was no working basis. Why? Because they are so far from the minimum protection that there's no discussion. In terms of the protection provided when citizens relate with companies which take information out of Europe, well, there is an aspiration of this regulation that protection will increase, and that that aspiration is obvious on the new rules about international data transfer. But the problem, and unlike data processing when it's in the EU, it's not a legal problem from a substantive point of view. It has to do with diplomacy and diplomatic issues. If Argentina or Chile give me the assurances that they're going to deal with the data, European data, properly, then that is good. And from a diplomatic point of view, the pressure the EU can exert on these two countries is also great. If we talk about the US, well, all we can do is expect and hope that diplomatically data protection will be upheld. We want to try and create pressure so that the markets that we sell to, and we talk about the safe harbor, the US, but there's no point in even going into China if you think that the US is poor at protecting data. Well, there's no point in even talking about China. It's important for people to know and understand that when they buy a product from a given company that they have to then supply information, personal information to, it's very important that they understand where it's going to. If it's going out of the EU, then the protection drops immediately. If it's going to a country with adequate protection, then it's another scenario. So we have all sorts of different cases. Well, I have all sorts of curiosities about the matter, but I think that there are some questions in the audience. So first of all, a question down the bottom. Could you please introduce yourself and also say who you're addressing your question to? Good morning. My name is Renato Passo. I'm from Claranet. My question would be suitable for both speakers, but maybe I'll address it to Domingos Farinha because it has to do more with processes. So I'd like to know to what extent the relationship between processes and controllers is an important one, and that how can this supersede the regulation in any way in a concrete case? Is it possible, my question is it possible for a controller to abdicate from the processor's responsibilities because of price issues, and when wanting and looking for a cheaper service, abdicates from some assurances that the processor could provide, and by doing this, is there any legal issue that can be raised?
Okay, I'll begin with Professor Domingos.
Your answer was, except for, let's say, some very exceptional cases, the answer is no. The regulation says very clearly that in the relationship, and if I well understood your question, the relationship between the controller and processor, that between the two, I have to ensure to the holder of the data what I expected from the controller. How I'm going to do this in my relationship between processor and controller, Article 28 says that there are a series of demands and requirements that have to be met. For instance, in terms of processing, data processing, if I don't comply with the demands when hiring a processor, if the processor does not provide these requirements, then I have to do them in-house and make assure them in-house. If the processor does not fulfill the requirements, the controller has to always provide and fulfill all the requirements. Imagine we have a package of 10. Package of 10 can be passed on to a processor, which is typical in the US, and distribute 9 or even 10 and do absolutely nothing as a controller, just manage processes, which is fine, providing the holder when, for instance, saying that some information needs to be changed or corrected because there was some mistake, controller cannot say that, oh, we're not the ones doing that, we have processors dealing with it, because you can't do that because that's the responsibility of the controller. So we establish a contract directly with the holder, owner of the data. And what this client is going to say is that I contracted these services with you, and you are responsible towards me for ensuring fulfillment.
With what was just said, it is, of course, an important distinction between controller and processor, because under current law, the controller has most of the compliance responsibilities, and the responsibility of the data processor is more limited. However, this changes under the GDPR, as was described, and there are many more responsibilities now on the data control, on the data processor, which I think reflects the realization that this distinction traditionally has been a bit artificial, because it's very difficult sometimes to distinguish what is a controller, what is a processor. Many times the roles of the two are mixed together. So the GDPR, I think, takes a bit of a more realistic approach to this. But it means that companies that are data processors will have a lot more responsibilities on them than is now the case.
Pessoas, por favor.
Good morning, my name is Gonçalo Rijo. My question is the following. The EU is a reference from an applications point of view. Many of these applications are exported to other countries, some to the African Portuguese-speaking countries. And the fact that we are working with the data of some of these countries, this new regulation, what impacts will it have? Because we're not talking about data of European citizens, but of third country citizens.
Yes, that's a very good question. And it's been indeed a question in the past. What happens when you're importing data to process from third countries and then you send it back? Is this still covered by European law? And the answer has generally been yes, it is covered. So I don't think this will really change under the GDPR. The rules for data transfers are not, to my mind, are not changed so much under the GDPR. It's one of the areas where there may be fewer changes than in some other sections. But if you're importing data from a third country and it's going to be processed here, certainly EU law will attach to it. And then when it's going to be sent back, there must be a legal basis for that. This can be covered usually in the contract with the parties who are sending you the data. You have to already have some commercial agreement with them, so you can include this in the commercial agreement. But the scope of EU data protection law is made much broader, as I said, because of the GDPR. And really, if you're an entity in Portugal or anywhere else in the EU and you're going to be processing personal data, you can assume that the GDPR will apply to it, to your processing.
I think the answer has been given, but as I thought that this was an important question raised, I wanted to ask a question back to you. As I understood, applications are produced in the EU and exported to third countries, namely Portuguese-speaking countries. And so the company established in Portugal, creating the application. Your question is that that company has access to data from these African countries. Well, within the scope of the application, a series of data is brought into our own infrastructures, worked on within our database. Okay, so the answer has been given by Professor Cunha.
Bom dia. O meu nome é Nuno Galveia, sou responsável por segurança de informação numa empresa privada.
Good morning. My name is Nuno Galveia. I work for a private security company. When we talk about data and fragmentation or with this new RGPD, are we looking at local governments and authorities creating additional changes and exceptions to the RGPD, bringing back the fragmentation which we have tried to move away from? As we have nowadays mechanisms and several mechanisms which aim at coordinating the different national authorities and coordinating them with the central authority. And given the extremely and highly protective nature of this regulation, I don't see that certain interpretations or provisions may not be raised in terms of how the regulation has to be applied. I think that's possible. Obviously, we're talking about predicting the future, but in reflecting on what this power concentration will be in terms of the central authority, we will have to look at this in terms of how these authorities are going to carry this out and how they're going to interpret their own national roles. And there is an opportunity and a leverage for national authorities to actually have their own interpretations, which will then qualify these, or which will translate into stricter ways of applying the regulation in different member states. But if I have well understood the regulation, that's going to then immediately cause a reaction from the central authority, because the idea is that there are no discrepancies and that there are no additional protective measures in the different EU countries.
With that answer, and indeed, in theory, as I said, there is supposed to be harmony and harmonization. However, this is where things become a bit tricky. If you look at the GDPR, there are certain articles that make it clear that there is still possibility for differences between member states. So Chapter 9 lists a number of these situations, processing of personal data and freedom of expression, processing of personal data concerning health, processing and employment law, processing for historical, statistical, and research purposes, rules of data protection, rules of churches and religious associations. These are all areas where there is a possibility already built in into the GDPR for having different national rules. And these are fairly important areas, and they can be fairly broad. So I anticipate that there will be some divergence between them. And then this will become a matter for the Data Protection Board, but also, I think, for the courts to determine how much variation is acceptable within. It's a difficult balance. On the one hand, this is supposed to be harmonized, but then the regulation does give some leeway to member states, but there must be a limit to that. So this will probably be something that the courts will have to decide eventually.
Faça favor, dê-me só segundo para a mais.
Another question? This gentleman, and then you can ask a question later.
Pertence à Universidade do Porto. Eu voltava a...
From Benjamin Tunch. I'd like to go back to the question that was already answered. I've got more doubts and certainties at the moment. The question is just about two cases. One is the Facebook. What changes in relation to this Facebook case? If I wanted to complain about Facebook, do I go to Ireland or what? And so what has changed? And the second question is about the one-stop shop. From the point of view of companies, I understand that this is essential and it's important to have a one-stop shop in Europe. But from the point of view of the citizens, I've got a number of fears that we are going to get things are going to be worse because we have the question of penalties, for example, 4%, and the question of freedom. The companies are obviously going to make a monetary choice, and they're going to choose the DPA that has the tradition of having the lowest penalties. I don't know if whether you agree with me or not, the lowest fines, that is. Thank you.
Well, there will be certain things that change under this Facebook case, as we describe, which is the Schrems case, which both of us refer to. And one of the most important was is even if, let's say, taking Facebook as an example, they have a lead regulator under the one-stop shop in Ireland, you will still have, or you will have the ability to complain directly to your regulator here in Portugal. So you will no longer have to go starting to write letters in Ireland to people in Ireland. So even if the company is mainly dealing with one regulator, this regulator has to communicate with the other regulators, and people, individuals, can can deal with only their own home regulator. Now, how will this work in practice? As I said, I think it's going to require a much better level of communication between the regulators than has been the case. Will this result in some sort of forum shopping for penalties? Well, it shouldn't, because the penalties have to be approved by the Data Protection Board. So in theory, this should also have some effect to prevent companies from just going to the member state where they think there's the softest enforcement regime. But again, it's hard to know how this will work in reality until it actually begins.
Well, I feel like being cynical and say, as to Facebook, nothing's going to change. Well, as to Facebook, your first question, but nothing's going to change. Well, I'm the safe harbor has been changed to the privacy shield. And there's been a number of novelties, for example, and so there is also two different mechanisms in terms of disputes, etc., or litigation, and there's a possibility of the authorities to work directly with the Department of Commerce. But the final line is this. Because still is a very strange it's a very mechanism, very different from what we're used to. I mean, there's an ideological side. For example, we're talking about two paradigms of personal data. I mean, there's a liberal one by companies that says fine, and the other one is that that if we don't agree with your processing of data processing, then we're going to fine you. And so, for example, what we did was we increased the bar. And it's true that the privacy shield, but it seems to require more, demand more from the United States than I think it does. But it still keeps the stress on one point, which is the Department of Commerce that decides to use this previous list, safe harbor list of companies. And so when I say that things are going to stay the same, given that it motivated the Facebook decision, the problems of the court is the following. I have no guarantees that the information is not going to be used in such a way that it's going to breach the standards of the European Union. I'm not saying that this couldn't happen here, which it would, as it's happened in the United States. But it didn't. Things haven't changed. And, of course, a number of procedural things have changed, as I said a while ago. There are new mechanisms. But cynically, I think very little has changed, almost nothing. Thank you very much. My name is Daniel Reis. I'm a lawyer. I have two questions. One is I'd like to know both speakers' opinion, whether they believe that the privacy shield is going to survive the attack from Hamburg. And the other specific question about the one-stop shop, I'm going to change to English, as a gentleman.
Establishment and main establishment seem to me to be quite old-fashioned, and a lot of multinational companies will not have a main establishment, as defined in the regulation. And as a result, in my opinion, the one-stop shop mechanism will not be available for those companies. I would like to ask your opinion on if you think this is right, or if it's not, what's your opinion on this point? Thank you.
Desculpa, essa pergunta é só para o Dr. Kuhner?
Para
okay.
So the questions for both?
With the last question, okay? Dr. Okay. Kuhner.
Well, the last question was the one-stop shop point, yes. I think, and I agree with you. The rules are unclear, and they don't necessarily fit the reality of the way that international corporations are structured now. It's sometimes hard to say this is the main establishment and this is mainly concerned with processing data. This responsibility may be may be divided over different entities. But I do think this will still be applied, because what has happened when in current law, when there are data protection provisions that don't seem to fit the reality, well, we just bend them to try to fit the reality. So there will, I think, be some dispute about what is the correct regulator, the correct lead DPA for different companies. But I don't doubt that we will come up with compromises in this regard, which may be bad compromises. And there has to be a certain amount of precedent and experience also with this to see how it will work in practice. Thank you.
Eu, quanto a esta última questão, não...
As to this last question, I have nothing else to add. I think that I would like to move on to the question of Privacy Shield. Well, from what I said in the previous answer, that I don't really trust the Privacy Shield very much in relation to the specific contents of the criticisms of the Trump's judgment. But especially, and this question is interesting, taken into account that whoever's on this side of the field are the Germans. This is just to qualify this aspect. They're not just they're traditionally very critical in the way that North American corporations process their personal data, but on the day of the judgment, or 2 days after the Schrems decision, to the from one of the DPA suspended the contracts that the EU said that the arguments that were applied to Safe Harbor were applied to those clauses as well, so therefore we're going to suspend them. And that is why the Germans are ready to fight against a decision of this type and to provoke it. But whether it's going to survive or not, as I said a while ago, my answer is, well, I mean, with no certainties. Unless there is a change on that side that gives the Court of Justice trust in the mechanisms and the number of requirements that arose from the decision, there has to be an independent authority able to provide citizens with guarantees. As we're not going to the United States, this hasn't happened yet, even with the Privacy Shield. It says that there is going to be an alternative resolution, etc., but it depends on how long it takes. There may be major changes in the United States, but that will change the understanding of the Court of Justice. I don't believe it may happen, though.
Well, if you ask about what is the possibility that the Privacy Shield will survive, I think we have a period of time now where it will be tested, and also we will have to see how it works in practice. There isn't a lot of difference between the principles of the Privacy Shield and the Safe Harbor, really, when you look at them. The Privacy Shield is much longer, and there are many more commitments of different U.S. government bodies, but it's not so different. So really what will be crucial is how does it work in practice? And we need to have this tested really independently, and I think we will see what the result is maybe in a year or two. There are, of course, other court tests now to data transfer regulation coming up. There's a current Schrems case in Ireland, which is testing the standard contractual clauses. There's a recent opinion of Advocate General against transfer of airline passenger data to Canada. So the Court of Justice has set a very high level of protection necessary, certainly I could see this going either way. I could see the court striking down the Privacy Shield, or I could see them maybe focusing on some of the improvements and saying, let's give this a bit of time. But we have a window of a couple of years, and much will happen in that time, so I don't think we can really predict this. But I do think the privacy shield is a bit on the, I'm trying to think of the English term, it's a bit shaky, and it really, we really have to have some strong demonstration that there's something has changed and that it's really working well in practice, or I think its fate could be in jeopardy.
Creio que não há mais perguntas. Há mais uma.
Well, one more question. Thank you very much. Carlos Peter Bril, lawyer. I would just like to ask the following. It was already mentioned here that processing and a joint responsibility, joint liability, codes of conduct, alternative solution of litigation, administrative reaction. So we have an increase of protection, but we can also have an increase in reactions. And no mention has yet been made to another perspective, which is the criminal protection. Now, how are you going to articulate this with administrative protection, especially as regards the of responsibility, that is individual responsibility, collective responsibility, and the with a possible breach of the principle of, or there's going to be an excessive reaction as to the two reactions regarding the same breach of data protection. That's all.
Bem, eu não vou alongar muito na resposta.
I'm going to try and be as brief as possible because the criminal I'm rather limited, but what I can say is that this question of an administrative offence, non-busy needum, which is a question that was raised since the Schrems question, taking into account that there's that we know that this is going to return. But as to this aspect, what I think here is that if we only look at the regulation given that the regulation sort of tempered the levels of reaction, and so I think the internal legal systems would actually do the same. So in terms of reactions, I don't think this regulation implies a greater reaction, overreaction, that is, these mechanisms already existed before this regulation in terms of being able to criminally react. And so those are considered breaches to the exercise of right and personal data protection. They are still the same. The regulation wanted to make it clearer what the means that existed. I don't know whether you were thinking about this when you asked the question. I admit that somebody with an intention of using the guarantees available in the light of the regulation to overload the system can do this. So there's one more question.
Só mais uma pergunta.
Just one last question, picking up on what was said by the former speaker about what's going to happen with Facebook. I was hoping that apart from the safe harbor response, that there'd be a sanction and that the 4% would be applied in terms of sanctioning. This would allow me to get a better picture. Will there be a fine to pay or not? Well, in the regulatory framework, picking up on what was said yesterday, we still have the national framework. But I understand your question. If that happened now under the new regulation, well, if we leave out the extremely complicated situations for which we don't all necessarily have an answer, but if we were able to apply a fine to Facebook, then that would be ideal. But we'd have to speculate on what the fine would be applicable to. Yes, Facebook could pay more. I don't know if I understood your question. Well, we are just really coming to a close, and I want to ask a question which has to do with Brexit. What are the member states, or is there any benefit? Because if the UK or exits, or when it exits, the EU, the companies established there will not be able to have their main establishment there necessarily. So what member states may benefit from this? We don't know how things are going to happen. Could you please give us an insight?
But I do also teach in the UK, and I try to follow the debate somewhat. It seems to me like a purely political debate now, and we don't really know the outcome, and it will depend on the political choices made. Certainly, there are, you know, every area of EU law is affected here, and it's not just data protection. This will affect everything. Thousands and thousands of EU laws that apply in the UK will be affected, including data protection. And the obvious question will be, what will be the final agreement? So this will also determine the data protection outcome. So if the EU, if the UK joins the European Economic Area, no problem. Like Norway, etc. They will have to apply, you know, enact EU data protection law. What if they don't, though? Then they will be treated as a third country, and you will not be able to transfer data to the UK without having a legal basis. Now, that's, I think, really unfortunate, and it goes against our whole desire in Europe to be able to move freely between member states, to work in different member states and visit, etc. But it's something we have to see for the future, and it shows, as I said in the end of my presentation, how important all of this is going to be held hostage to the general political climate in the EU. We can't deal with data protection by itself as a hermetically sealed area without seeing the great shifts and the great currents of the way the EU is working. And so none of this is going to work properly if the EU starts to break apart. And I truly hope it doesn't. But we have a lot of important challenges in this regard in the future.
Professor Domingos Farinha, your opinion on the matter? Well, I agree with what was said. I think that the issue here, and over the last decades, the decades during which the UK was in the EU, created the relationship between the UK market and the other member states' markets. This will change in a way, but the UK will remain a natural, obvious partner of EU countries. And so we will have to find a way now in regulating Brexit, which we don't quite know how it will take place, but we have to find and come up with some sort of data protection regime between the EU and the UK. And we'll have to create, as we created the safe harbor for the Americans, and as we created the protection or adequate protection levels for other states, we also have to find the best way to deal with in this special scenario our relationship with the UK in terms of data protection. And I think we have the instruments to be able to overcome the hurdles which may present. Okay, well, we have now come to an end of this first panel. We'll be breaking for lunch, and we will be resuming afternoon session at 2 p.m. with the topic Impact Organizations. And I hope you have enjoyed this morning's session. Thank you.
Thank you.